Therapists are usually really stuffy people, old people that don't understand how technology works or how games work. I'm one of the few people at my university as an instructor who, like, even though I barely understand computers, I'm the tech whiz because, I don't know, maybe I'm Asian or I don't know. Just I know how to, like, install software or something. And so what this means is that a lot of therapists, in my experience, are not very tech savvy. They're phobic of computers, and they're also not very aware of geek culture or how to integrate geek culture, how to relate to their clients regarding, say, video games or, you know, other geek culture things, movies, Star Wars, comic books, the stuff that, like, regular people are into. And as a family therapist, I have to say that when I am talking with teenagers in particular and young adults, that's their entire life. For some people, that's their entire life. And to not understand that, at least in some way, is a huge barrier between therapist and client. And if you can know that world, and there are a few therapists that do, and when you actually know that world and possess that world and actually, like, are a geek yourself, clients will, you know, love to come to therapy because they can't wait to talk to that person about all that kind of stuff who can relate to them and about all these things. And so there's some movement in our industry to have a greater presence. Maybe as younger therapists are starting to enter the field, there's this movement to involve more of this in the therapy room and in helping kids to develop in ways that we might want to help them with, social skills or even how to learn different topics like math or language, or and even in therapeutic arenas, trauma recovery, you know, this kind of stuff. And so one of the, I think, tips of the spear that are doing this are Adam Johns and Adam Davis, who have been on the podcast before. We've had episodes talking about Dungeons & Dragons therapy, but it's really much more than that. And they approached me recently and asked if I would – they're starting a nonprofit soon. And the announcement is coming up. Well, by the time this episode comes out, the announcement will have already been made at PAX in early September. So this episode will probably come out. This must be the first week of September when this comes out. And they asked me to be on their board as president of their nonprofit that is its mission statement is, and they'll be able to, they're here in the room with me, and they'll be able to articulate the mission better. But just as a summary, is to propagate the usage of games in a therapeutic or community enhancing way. And I think it's a wonderful thing, and we'll probably be doing periodic episodes about this. And so I thought, so this is the launch. This is the launch episode of the podcast. I'm coming out of the closet, if you will, as president of the board of what is called Game to Grow. And I've had have Adam Johns and Adam Davis, both the are you the executive directors? The executive directors of the nonprofit on the podcast. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
us. It's great to be here.
This is my third time on this podcast.
Yeah. This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda, and I'm president of the board of the nonprofit Game to Grow. So did I articulate that well as the mission to I'm sure I flubbed it, but tell us the full mission.
You did great, Kirk. So Game to Grow was founded on the idea that games of all kinds have the power to improve people's lives. And the benefits of these games can be improved by playing the game intentionally.
Don't just game to grow.
Don't just game to grow.
Yeah.
I like it. So that's going to be the tag.
That might be our tagline. There might be some shirts with that on.
Yeah.
On that.
So who are you trying to appeal to, and what exactly are you going to be doing for people?
I mean, ultimately, the goal of Game to Grow is really to expand a lot of the benefits that we've already seen in some of our work with Wheelhouse Workshop, where we've been using role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons to help people, to help kids largely with social skill development. Game to Grow is going to take those amazing improvements that we've seen within that and build on that concept to expand it to all kinds of games and across a much wider audience of individuals and challenges. So far our focus has been social skills, but what we've seen has opened the doors to this possibility that games could be great for depression and anxiety and PTSD and not just in a therapeutic setting either, but also in education and in community development purposes. And what we want to do with Game to Grow, what Game to Grow is really going to accomplish is that it's going to expand on those ideas and help people learn how to play games with intentionality to help them improve.
Right.
And not just professionals either, but also in family settings. We want to help families be able to play board games together and have some knowledge of we're working on these skills together, or we're communicating better because we're playing this game together.
Yeah, and to be specific, and we've talked about this in more detail in other episodes, but you two have been, over the past number of years, led different social skills groups in which you have 8 to 10 teenagers. Are some of them young adults, or are they all teenagers?
Our age range goes from about 9 to about early 20s.
Okay, so from 9 to early 20s, about 8 to 10 of these guys. Have you had any girls yet? Are they all? Some girls.
Some girls.
We have about 10% girls.
Okay, yeah. So a mixture of people, and they come to play Dungeons and Dragons, which they love, and they get super into it because Dungeons and Dragons is super fun. And you lead these groups as the Dungeon Master, but also in a helpful way, in a therapeutic way, if you will, that can help these individuals not only have fun, but also develop social skills, which can be very complicated in terms of how to help people develop social skills. Other models of helping social skills often are way less effective in my experience. For instance, you'll have a 15-year-old who is getting angry at school and doesn't have a lot of friends and is being bullied even. And they go to therapy. And that, because that's usually the first thing people think of, you know, because they don't think social skills. They think, oh, this kid is struggling, so send him to a therapist. He goes to a therapist, and the therapist, you know, is trying their best. But the therapist is 30-something. It's just, you know, is very accommodating and isn't a real person in the real world. The client, you get down on the ground, you could play games and stuff, but and the therapist will try, like, oh, you seem a little frustrated. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, these can be excellent ways of helping people. But if you actually put, you know, this 16-year-old fictional fellow in a group of other 9 individuals, each with their own personalities and their own quirks, and then you have this leader, and you're playing a game that you enjoy, which is highly social and very interactive and very, you have to put yourself out there, and you create an environment that encourages pro-social behavior, right? Because you can play Dungeons and Dragons in any way you want. You could play it in a way that everyone was evil. When I was in college, we played an evil campaign where it was terrible. I couldn't do it, but the whole idea was to just be a villain and just kill the innocent and stuff. It was terrible. But obviously you wouldn't do that. So you're setting up a game in which they are rewarded by gold and experience points and even just accolades among their peers to help, to assist, to be nice, to work out conflicts. And that's what you guys have been doing for a number of years now. And so you thought, hey, what if we expanded this into a much bigger thing? Because you were getting a lot of attention from this, right? You were going to PAX. This organization is still around that you're a part of, called Wheelhouse Workshop. Mm-hmm. And you were getting a lot of attention for this. And tell me, what was the inspiration to expand this exactly?
Well, we've been working in therapeutic social skills groups using role-playing games for about 5 or 6 years now. And we've seen so many of the benefits, and we wanted to expand it to serve a larger range of populations. The nonprofit status would give us the ability to serve different populations in different parts of Seattle. We'd like to expand into South Seattle, into some more communities that are deeply in need of social services, but are not in the don't have the capacity to pay for private pay services.
Yeah, and to be specific, is you're able to get donations and funding from other nonprofits or other philanthropy essentially, and that gives you the ability to provide services to people who can't afford to pay anything for it.
Right.
So that's what you're, to be specific on the funding, that's what you're saying.
Right. Mm-hmm. We've been having a lot of success in the greater Seattle area. Right now, we do all private pay through Wheelhouse Workshop. We offer a whole lot of sliding scales. We don't tend to turn people away. And that right now has been hard to run a for-profit company in that way. And so we've always wanted to expand into more communities, but as this is our job, we have to pay ourselves, and it's been hard to set that price point in a way that it will exclude anybody. And so we're looking forward to being able to bring our work into hospitals, bring our work into schools in South Seattle, farther to populations that are in deep need of services.
And you want to start training other people to do it. You're already starting to do a bit of that for other clinicians. You want to grow the organization eventually so that all these other groups can be headed by other people other than yourselves, right? So was that it? What was that a major part of it? Your people were coming to you and saying, this is kind of expensive. And then you're getting bummed out by that and thinking like, man, there's got to be a solution to this.
I mean, that was definitely a part of it. But I think a lot of it is on the idea that as a nonprofit, we sort of make a statement, not just to companies, but also to individuals, to families and people who are interested in this and go, wow, that's a great idea. But I can't do anything with that. And as a nonprofit, we give that availability that now if you want to help support this and help us grow it into something that is beyond something that's just run by two guys and helps to expand, teach other people how to do this, helps to really spread the word about why this is such a good idea. Now we have that platform to be able to say, look, we are doing this for the benefit and the charity of being able to build on this concept and to get the word out to other people. And whether that word is training others on how to use games therapeutically, or whether that word is just letting people know games can be beneficial and here's some ways in which they can be beneficial, that's what we really want to build on.
Right, so it's not just that you will be offering services, which you will be, direct services to people, but you're also wanting to spread essentially the idea and the culture and the notion that games can be used in this way. And as I was saying in the beginning of the episode, it's just my own take on culture, as there's this huge gap between clinicians and what regular people do with their lives, as a trainer of family therapists, I always run into this with novice therapists. I mean, Adam, I don't know if you remember this. Maybe you don't because you were already playing games, but there's always this point where in the first 2 quarters of internship, the intern will say to me, so my teenagers, they're not talking. My kids, they're not talking. I'm trying to get them to talk, and they're just saying, I don't know all the time. And I will say this is a simplification, of course, of the conversations throughout those quarters. But essentially, I'll say something like, well, you're not going to be able to talk with a 7-year-old or an 8. There's some 7-year-olds are verbal and you can have a conversation with them, but the vast majority you can't. You have to actually go into their world of play and whatever that is, whatever appeals to them. It could be puppets, could be board games, but it could also be video games. And how many therapeutic offices have a video game set up? In fact, I would actually just, take this another level. I would say most therapists consider video games to be the bane of development. It's addiction to video games and it corrupts the mind. Again, because of this cultural divide, right? I mean, how many graduate school courses are titled, like, you know, use of video games in therapy, right? I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, it's never, didn't come up in my program.
Yeah, what chapter in a family therapy book talked about video games and using video games with your clients? I mean, it's just, you know, it's absurd, but that there's so much potential there, you know? Instead of just being like, okay, play Call of Duty, that's therapeutic. You're like, that's not what we're talking about, right? We're talking about, like, maybe even designing a particular game or having, you know, because the way you guys play Dungeons and Dragons or other, you know, tabletop games with people, you mold it as a clinician, as someone who is thinking about this sort of thing in an intentional way that shapes the experience for people that's both fun and helpful to them in terms of the goals of them, you know, having more social skills, which helps them to have more friends and da 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 da. So and the sky's the limit when it comes to all the other things that young people involve themselves in, right?
Well, there's a lot of benefits that these games have very intuitively. Dungeons and Dragons is a game because of its because of the fact that it's a game you play around a table with other people. It relies on your social skills to be successful. It also has reward structures built in that some are intrinsic and some are extrinsic. The better your team works together, the more likely you are to defeat the enemies and get the XP, win the loot, etc. There's also, as the facilitators, we can harness the sort of intrinsic motivations to help them realize that you enjoy playing with people when you have pro-social behaviors. And the same thing is true about video games. There's a lot of video games, you might say Call of Duty does not have any benefits. Call of Duty is a war game, you're shooting people, it's very overtly violent. But also, there's a lot of tactics, a lot of creative problem-solving you might need to do that you might need to do with other people. So we might be able to play Call of Duty with a group of people and help them figure out how to communicate with each other in such a way that we can collaboratively come up with that tactic, where I could tell you everything to do, and you might hate me and do everything opposite. We might be the worst team of Call of Duty players ever. Or we could, with some intentional facilitation, have them reflect on maybe their strengths as a leader, maybe their challenges in following directions or vice versa, and then translate those skills from the game into other parts of their lives. Because people oftentimes will harness a part of themselves they don't realize they have when they play these games. You might not think of yourself as being someone who is very good at your frustration tolerance, but yet you totally got to the very end of Dark Souls, one of the hardest, most frustrating games I've ever played in my life. But I found in myself when playing Dark Souls that I was really good at challenging myself and trying again and not giving up. And then there were times in my life that I said, oh, I'm going to play this. I'm going to do this thing like I do Dark Souls. I'm going to try this again. I'm not going to give up. I'm just going to think about the strength that I have when playing Dark Souls. And I can use that when I'm working on things at work, when I'm working on things in my social life, out there in the community. I can translate the skills that I've got in games. And that's part of the thing we're doing with young people right now, is helping people realize the strengths you have when you're playing Gragnold the Dwarf Barbarian, you can actually use in your real life. You can take the strength, the self-advocacy, all those things, and be that at school. Maybe not, you know, might not pick up a chair and throw it the way you did in the tavern brawl, but you might be able to use some of that strength.
Right, yeah. I, growing up, played Dungeons & Dragons and other games since fifth grade, and I, as you guys talk about it, I just think about how I developed and how I learned lessons about who I was and about what was right and about how to work with other people while playing those games. Because I was so obsessed fifth, sixth grade, seventh grade, I think, that was pretty much all I wanted to do all the time. And so with my friends, I can remember, I don't remember a lot about those times, it was a long time ago, but I can remember so many details about the games that we played back then. And so, and my friends do too. Like we still, there was this one time when it's fifth grade and we were at recess and we didn't have any dice and we didn't have any of our D&D stuff with us. And I improvised like a 10-person game in which we got pebbles that we kind of marked as like winning or not winning, you know, and we rolled the pebbles on the blacktop, you know. And one of my friends still remembers that. He's like, remember that time when you like improvised this Dungeons and Dragons game with pebbles as dice? So, like, that was the best, you know. And the game probably lasted like 5 minutes because it's recess. It's, you know, but there's something. I mean, and so what I'm saying is, like, even for myself, I know that if I would be a different person, I think, without those experiences. They're very meaningful because you still have a sense of imagination, and your brain can go into all these wondrous places with other people. You know what I mean?
Here's my question to you, though, Kirk. How did you, or when did you start reflecting on the benefits that it had for you?
Just now, I think.
And that's one of the things we realize is a lot of people play games. I think 97% of people play games of some sort.
Yeah.
And there's all these benefits you can have by playing these games. And even more so if you are encouraged to reflect on it, if you're encouraged to reflect and to translate. So yeah. The benefits that you had as a fifth grader or a sixth grader, imagine if someone had been there to help you realize the benefits you were getting out of that and could help you sort of build that confidence and build that imagination, that creative spirit that you had into school or into church or into whatever your community is.
Yeah. And that's what you guys do and what you're going to train other people to do.
And functionally, I think some of the stuff that you mentioned earlier about the idea of how therapists create engagement and how games are a very real part of people's lives, and they are a super engaging aspect to that. And I love playing games. I feel powerful in games, or I feel just enthusiastic. I'm having a really good time. And there isn't any particular reason that we can't jump on that idea and say, awesome, you're enthusiastic about this. Let's use that and that enthusiasm and that passion that you have for it and build on those ideas of what the game's already benefiting you for. And let's be intentional about that and extrapolate that piece along with that enthusiasm for those benefits.
Yeah, enthusiasm. When I talk with people about this, because it's, you know, we've had board meetings and people are like, what are you doing, you know, today on a Sunday? And so I have to explain, I'm going to this board meeting, what the hell? I'm going to say, well, I'm, you know, I'm on the board for this nonprofit that's coming out called Game to Grow. And they're like, what is it? And I'd say, well, it's in a nutshell, it is an organization that is trying to make it so that is what basically what I come back to, what I say very, you know, briefly is, imagine kids not only wanting to go to therapy, but dying to go to therapy and having the therapy actually work. Like that's the thing, right? That it's helpful therapy, and the teenagers, young adults, children are dying to go. It's that marriage between, you know, intentional services, therapeutic or otherwise services, with the things that people actually enjoy doing. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, imagine if you went to work and, I don't know, like, there was something actually fun to do there. Something, I don't know. We tend to think about therapy and clinical services as something that isn't fun, right? We think of it as something that is supposed to be work. It's supposed to be hard work. And if it's fun, it's not. So that's another thing is another barrier with novice therapists is like, I feel like we're just talking. I feel like we're just playing games. You know, because in their head, they have therapy as this thing in which they confront someone and the person like has this revelation or something. And certainly it can be like that. But it can also be in the midst of play, in the midst of, you know, you're playing Call of Duty with your client and you're sitting there and you're, you know, split screening or something and you're playing the game. And then while you're playing the game, the kid starts talking about their mom or something because they're relaxed and they are bonding with you or something. Now, that's not using the game therapeutically, but it's using the game as a way to get them comfortable and to make you seem like you're with them and you're interested in their world and all that kind of stuff, you know? So,
and a lot of that is in that sort of relationship building, right? Similar to when you were in the playground and you were rolling rocks. I mean, those are the stories and the times that you're really going to remember. And those are the relationships that you build. It's those stories that help build that relationship. Right. And in a lot of senses, games help give us that. They help give us that space where we are really engaging and we're really feeling connected to other people. And even when you're sitting side by side on a couch and shooting each other in Call of Duty, you're building on that relationship and you're building on those ideas. And that relationship is a super key point to any therapist session, certainly, but to all aspects of being able to grow and change and open up to others. And those are really important.
Yeah, before I forget, there is a planned Antioch function. So you're both Antioch grads. Adam Johns, you're from the Couple and Family Therapy program, mm-hmm. in which I'm core faculty. Adam Davis, you're from the Master's in Education program and Drama Therapy. And there's an event coming up at Antioch University, Seattle, in Belltown. The date is set, right?
September 7th.
Yeah. September 7th. Okay, so we should probably release this episode like right away, like maybe during
because
PAX is the first, and that's when you're going to make the announcement of Game to Grow at PAX. You've been to PAX before, and you've been highlighted at PAX in panels.
This is actually our sixth PAX.
Your sixth PAX, PAX West, the original PAX, right? And so you're going to make the grand announcement there. So this episode, I guess, would come out on the 2nd, I suppose. So on the 7th at Antioch, there's going to be an open house public event that I'm guessing will be free, and anyone can come. So if you want to meet Adam and Adam, I actually can't be there because I'm going to be at a camp that I go to once a year. This camp hires me as a psychology person, which bums me out. But anyway, you'll be there and you'll be demonstrating what Game to Grow can actually provide for clinicians and for other people interested in this sort of thing and communities and clients and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Have you guys worked out what you want to do yet?
We're still talking with Rachel over there at Antioch about what the specifics of this event are going to be.
Okay.
But we guarantee it'll be fun.
Okay. Yeah.
If it's an Adam and Adam event, it'll be a good time.
At the very least, we'll definitely be talking. We'll be talking about like all of our dreams for what we want Game to Grow to be, and all of our goals in the future for how we want to expand and build on the idea of games and therapy, education, and community. So at the very least, it'll be inspirational because we'll be talking about all that stuff. So
yeah. And so what now, I want to highlight one particular thing that you want to do in the future and that you've already done a little bit of, which is training for other clinicians. What is that going to entail exactly?
Well, we actually had at Antioch University, Seattle, we had a 6-hour workshop we did there for part of their summer program a couple of years ago. And that was a 6-hour workshop where part of it was the theory behind what we do, specifically with tabletop role-playing games. We unpacked our code phrase of how tabletop role-playing games are therapeutically beneficial, which is scaffolded and aesthetically distanced play-based narrative transference.
Wow.
So if you're a theory junkie, so we talked about that with a great Prezi presentation, and then also taught them a game that we made up that they could use in their therapy settings, and then sort of workshopped with them, gave them some experiential component there to practice the skills of being a game master.
A game you made up other than D&D, or a game within D&D?
It's a shortened version of a tabletop role-playing game with a couple of dice, just for the basic principles of
that
what
makes
it looks
sense.
Like to be a game master.
That makes sense, because a lot of clinicians don't have the time to learn, because D&D can be a little, you know, it's, for me, growing up with Gygax and all that stuff, it's very familiar to me, but I'm guessing for people it's a steep learning curve, you can create a very quick and dirty way of playing, role playing games. Mm-hmm. What's the rules that you made up?
So the game is actually called Tri-Dice, and it effectively uses just if you're familiar with role playing games, it uses what are called fudge dice or fate dice, which are dice that are 6-sided dice, just like any board game dice, except that instead of numbers, they have 2 pluses on them, 2 minuses, and 2 blank sides. And so you use those, and by rolling those dice, you get to add the randomness to the world. But functionally, the game just has all of the very, very basic components of a game like Dungeons and Dragons, in the sense that there's one person who's a game master, and so they sort of lead the storytelling, and they clarify the rules, and they clarify what happens after you try to do something. And then everybody else who's playing a character, and the characters in the world can be pretty much anything that you want them to be. And so everybody has a little description that says who their character is, and what their name is, and what kinds of things they're good at, and what kinds of things they're not good at.
Like, I'm a warrior, and I'm good with a sword, and I'm bad with making jokes or something.
Right. It actually puts it into a sentence frame, I believe, is what we set up. Adam, do you remember the frame?
The sentence frame is, imagine it like Mad Libs. So you have a name, the fantasy race profession is good at and bad at.
Okay.
So then you can say Gragnold, the dwarf bookkeeper, is good at math and bad at throwing things.
Okay. Right.
And then in the game, Gragnold, the dwarven bookkeeper, might be really good, very high intelligence, and there might be situations in the game where that good at math might come up. He's very intelligent. You can extrapolate based on the good at and bad at other situations with the game master, where I might say to the game master, well, Gragnold's good at math. Could I also say that he might be able to discover or decipher this code, this puzzle, whatever,
and then I as the game master might say, yeah, you know what, your math skills do translate in this case. You can decipher this cipher in this book, but now you have to throw the book at somebody, and Gregor's not so great at throwing the book.
And in those instances, you'd have to maybe roll three pluses or something in order to
and functionally, that's sort of how the game breaks down. Is that when you roll the dice, you always roll three dice, and if it's something that you're good at or you can justify being good at this, then you'll get an extra plus bonus. And if it's something that you're bad at, then you'll get an extra minus bonus, okay, or bonus, an extra minus negative.
Right.
And so it helps distinguish. Part of the great thing about role-playing games is that they help create, you have to be good at some stuff and you have to be bad at some stuff.
Yeah.
And you have to juggle those two areas to make an interesting character.
Right. Yeah, I once designed a game similar to that. It was a little bit more complicated than that, but because I was getting tired of all the rules, and I just thought, you know, it really just comes down to you're good at things and you're not so good at other things. And then you just need like some kind of random number generator of some kind. Like, you don't need 10 different kinds of dice, da 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 da. You just need one way of, like, you know, let's see what happens here, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I totally understand it. And in a lot of ways, those kinds of games are funner because people don't get bogged down in like a bunch of rules. You know, as game masters yourself, I'm sure you've had this experience as a player too, perhaps, is, you know, you're playing this game, but everyone's got their head and their character and their head and the spell books, and they're trying to like game the system, you know, and they're not having fun and they're not interacting and they're not thinking about what their character cares about, you know?
And what you're talking about right there is the difference between gaming and playing.
Interesting.
And there's, our name is Game to Grow, and we fully love games, the games themselves, but if we're not doing it right, there's a chance that we're gaming without playing. And that's where you've got a lot of compulsive behaviors. You're looking at the extrinsic reward systems in these games, like Candy Crush can be very addicting. We talked at our video game addiction episode about Cookie Clicker, which is the least beneficial game I can think of, because you just click a cookie, but it has some reward structures in there. And if you can think about the way those games can be used differently, or the way that when you're reflecting on the fact that I'm gaming, I'm not playing. We're sitting here, we're both trying to win, we can't wait for this game to be over. We're not really playing with each other. And right. That's where the play is what gives the benefit to the social environment.
Right.
The play, when we are playing with our participants, that's where we're building the relationships. If we're gaming, if we're providing them very extrinsic rewards in a sort of a Skinner box to get them to provide, to do the appropriate behaviors for the appropriate response, then they're not having fun, and there's no benefit to that.
Yeah.
That'll last outside the game space.
Yeah, and that's where the two of you guys come in, because you're charismatic and fun as game masters that keep people's attention, right? You know, you don't just say like, okay, you enter a room and there are three kobolds. What do you do? You know, you go, you know, Gragnok the kobold comes out of the thing and he says, yeah, you finally arrived. I've been waiting all, you know, and you build it up, blah, blah, blah. And you have different characters, ongoing characters and voices, and, you know, you probably stand up and move around the room and that kind of stuff. And it's hard to have your nose in your character sheet when, you know, Adam's running around like a crazy person.
Right.
And we do a lot of encouraging for them to sort of meet us in that same space. Not only are we exemplifying that, right, by speaking in this kobold voice and really getting them to listen to what the kobold is saying to them, but then when Gragnold, the bookkeeper, turns around and wants to do something, wants to negotiate with the kobold, he might say, I negotiate him with him to make him go back into his cave. And we go, no, how about you stand up? What does Gragnold say? Yeah. How does he do his negotiation?
How do people react to that when you do stuff like that?
There's a sort of a scaffolding we have to do. So we're not going to do that on day one with a brand new player.
Too much.
Well, yeah. Well, it depends. Some players are ready to jump right in and do that. And there's a lot of intuition in how to do this well, which is sort of the challenge in training people, is that we're training intuition largely and knowing where to meet a player and where to challenge them, how to scaffold, how to build them up.
Yeah.
To make them successful. Because if a lot of the reason why this is so beneficial for social skills specifically is because social skills have to be met with success. You have to feel successful in order to want to keep trying again.
Right.
And so if we challenge them too much in a way that they don't feel successful, they will not want to come back.
Right. And you've been really successful today. Incidentally, after that episode on video game addiction, I played Cookie Clicker for the next month straight. I figured out there's a lot of math involved at the upper levels, and so I had a spreadsheet. It was terrible. But anyway, so
you found the benefits in Cookie Clicker. I didn't realize we're there. You use it to improve your math.
It's a ridiculous game, and then I actually found another game on my phone that's very similar to Cookie Clicker, and it's about chickens and I think aliens or something. But anyway, it's eggs. I think it's all based on egg production, and you end up getting into like the trillions of egg production on your farm. It's stupid. But anyway, the point is that you wasted a whole month of my life, Adam. Tell me about some of the successes you've had with some of your people that you've worked with. What have you seen? What have the parents told you? What have you seen?
A parent told us not too long ago that one of this parent's kids was told by their therapist that they would need years and years of psychotherapy before they would ever be able to function in a social group. And this young person came to our groups sort of tentatively at first. We weren't really sure how it was going to work out. And it turns out that they've been in our groups now for over a year and are now having meaningful social relationships outside of our groups.
Wow.
And I can't take all the credit for it, of course. But I know that a therapist had told this family that they would never be able to function in a social group. And coming weekly to play Dungeons & Dragons in our intentionally therapeutic sense, they've had the benefits and the challenges of being with people, and I will facilitate it very intentionally to make sure this young person is challenging their own abilities to be social, but feeling successful and being willing to take risks meeting other people.
Yeah. So in the beginning, this person was having trouble interacting with other people at school, probably not like any friends?
Some autism-related challenges on top of that. Some very strong fixations, some strong anxiety that was making it really hard for this young person to participate. And so the beauty of Dungeons & Dragons with randomness and with other people is that you have to become a little bit comfortable with unpredictability. Mm. You have to become comfortable with other people having different ideas than you and having different strengths than you and relying on other people and needing other people to be successful and realizing the benefits of look what we can accomplish when we work together.
Right. Yeah. In a sense, it's kind of like exposure therapy in that you're exposing people to what terrifies them, which is that randomness. A lot of times people who struggle with social skills will turn to video games and these kinds of games because there's an order to it, right? There's predictability and the game, you know, you press the trigger and it shoots the gun in the game. You play this tabletop game and it has a certain structure to it. You're supposed to do this now and then you do that. And in social life, it's infinitely variable and unpredictable.
Absolutely.
But everyone, even mildly autistic people, desperately want acceptance and a social community and fun in their lives, but will isolate because they, upon trying to interface with that will, as a younger person, will realize that it always goes badly for them. You know, they'll say something that will piss someone off. They'll get in trouble somehow. Someone will come at them with something that they weren't predicting, and mm-hmm. they don't know how to react, and they feel humiliated, or their feelings are hurt, or it could even get, you know, violent and, you know, bullying and this kind of stuff, or ostracizing. And so they retreat. But then in your groups, you are there to facilitate things, because, you know, you've told me stories about some of the group members, you know, coming to near altercations, or at the very least having negative feelings towards each other. And you're there to facilitate that week in and week out to help them pass that. But more on a mundane level, you're there to meet them where they're at. They come with whatever level of ability they have at that moment, and then you challenge them just a little bit beyond that, and then the next session a little bit beyond that, and a little bit beyond that. So with someone that has severe social skill deficits, in the first group, you're not going to just put them in the hot seat and say, like, do your best dwarf impression of, you know, books. You're going to maybe even never do that in the first few weeks, and like just them sitting in a room with, you know, seven other people is a big deal, and just allowing that for them to get comfortable with that, and then slowly they become more and more comfortable with the scariness of unpredictability.
And that's where the beauty of dice rolling comes in, because even in our daily lives, we might mess up doing things we've done 1,000 times. I trip up the stairs a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty able to climb stairs, but yet still, you know, occasionally I'll trip up the stairs.
Right.
I'll walk into a doorway. There's embarrassing things that happen to us.
Yeah.
So the nice thing about dice is it gives us a little bit of room for that. You're not going to, every time you walk upstairs, you're not going to succeed. Sometimes you're going to trip up the stairs. Hopefully you don't trip down the stairs, but it happens too.
Yeah.
And you have to deal with the repercussions of that. Sometimes you take a little damage, but you don't die. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's all right to have some of those.
I'm sure a big part of learning how to tolerate things that are difficult to tolerate, which is rolling badly. I have not learned how to tolerate that. I will throw away dice that are bothering me. You know what I mean?
Well, you can externalize it on the dice. That's what's so nice about it. It's because it's not you that tripped up the stairs. It's the dice that rolled. And what does Gragnold do when he trips up the stairs? Does he save face? Does he feel embarrassed? Does he try to not show it? Does he get angry and punch the wall? How does Gragnold deal with the frustration of tripping up the stairs, which is something he's done 1,000 times?
So not only do you get to externalize it to the dice and be like, oh, this dice rolled a 1 again. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
But you can also externalize it to Gragnold. And you can be like, "Ah, oh, Gragnold's being such a clumsy idiot today,"
right.
And it's not me who's tripping up the stairs, or it's not even me who's having difficulty negotiating with this king. You know, this is all Gragnold. That's on him to continue to have to threaten the king, even though that might not be the most effective
and
tactic here.
What advice would you give Gragnold, knowing that Gragnold is just totally messing up and negotiating with this king or dealing with whatever situation? What advice would you give Gragnold?
Right.
Oh, wow. You'd tell Gragnold to make eye contact. You'd tell Gragnold to broaden his chest, to look proud. What would that look like if you did that right now?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, now let's try again. Let's see what it looks like when Gragnold does it. Why don't you roll it again? We can break any rule we want to.
Right.
Or just do it. We don't even need you to roll for it. You did such a good job of role playing that we can select a time to roll the dice or not roll the dice. It doesn't matter, as long as the person feels successful doing it.
Right, right. Yeah, I just want to highlight the power of what you just demonstrated in that, again, therapist, client, you know, therapist saying, so you're having trouble at school. Maybe it's how you hold yourself. Maybe it's the way you talk to people. And the kid's like, what are you talking about? Like, this is stupid. Get me out of here. Mm-hmm. Whereas you masterfully they're already wanting to play the game. They already want to succeed. They already are enjoying themselves. And then you're getting them to play the game in a way that gets them to exhibit social skills. I'm not even putting this into words very well, but that you're trying to get them to do, all the while they're enjoying themselves and having fun, and then they get rewarded in the game, and then the rest of the group says, yeah, great job, and then that will translate and generalize into their regular behavior.
We actually had a very specific situation where we did that, where we had a young person came into our groups, and this young person's natural tendency was to sit with their legs up on the chair with their knees in front of their face, so that when they spoke, all their words would be muffled behind their knees. No one else could really understand them. And when we spoke to a parent and a teacher about this young person and trying to understand their therapeutic goals, they said their friendships at school are sort of fizzling out because people kind of think this person's strange. They think it's weird. Their body language is off-putting. Yeah. So with that information, we created a situation in the game where this young person who was playing a dwarf barbarian, we had their group have to infiltrate a fancy dinner party. So in order to find information about some corrupt magistrate or something like that, this was years ago, so I'm having trouble remembering the specifics of the plot. But they came into this fancy dinner party, and we had everybody sit at the table the way their characters were sitting. And so this young person who had their knees up had to put their legs down, put their arms on the table, and sit like Gragnold the dwarf barbarian. And so in this moment, the way that they had infiltrated this fancy dinner party was by pretending to be kings from other nations that they had all made up. So they came in, and there were a lot of like sycophantic little peon characters who were all played by me, who looked at them and thought they were just amazing. Look at all these magistrates and kings from other nations. And me, little peon, I looked at them with my eyes wide, like I was so excited to meet them. And then the peons didn't know how to sit at a table, and so they would look at Gragnold, the now pretending to be a king dwarf, and do what they did. The peon didn't know how to behave at the table because they were at the fanciest party this peon had ever been at. So then the peon played by me would spread my legs out and put my arms on the table, and then the young person playing Gragnold was playing up Gragnold, playing up this dwarf barbarian as someone who had no social skills. Gragnold the dwarf barbarian was kind of bumbling and loud and would take bread from the waiters walking by and just eat it and throw it around the room and stuff. And the peons played by me thought that was the appropriate thing to do. So the peons would also grab the bread and bite it and throw it, thinking it was the right thing, or slurp the squid ink pasta up from the plate. And this young person was... who had always sat with their legs around their face and speaking very quietly, got the opportunity to feel the rewards of being loud and taking up space and being bold and courageous. And the way that translated is from that point forward, this young person at the table took up more space. They were a little more comfortable playing Gragnold. They were a little bit more comfortable being bold and reaching out to other people.
They got to see sort of what the benefits of their change in body language gave in their expression, how they related to the rest of the people at the table, how that changed how other people saw it.
Right. Yeah. And again, just imagine trying to facilitate that in a one-on-one therapy room or in a group therapy situation in which you're just talking, you know, because my guess, you know, just taking a guess, he came to group to play games, and he sits down. He's like, okay, we're playing games. And then you set up the game, and you're like, okay, here's – and he's like, oh, and he's got his legs up. But in his mind, he's like, oh, this is going to be fun. You know, we're playing a game. Oh, we're going to this thing. Oh, what's going on? We're going to this dinner party. Oh, okay, that's interesting. And then all of a sudden, he's like, oh, I got to put my legs down. Oh, okay. Do you know what I mean? Like, it probably just doesn't register to him like – therapy is happening to me right now. You know? Mm-hmm. He's probably just like, oh yeah, I of course got to put my, okay, now what? Now what else do I have to do to, like, you know, make this work in the game, you know? And again, it's externalizing, as you're saying, Adam. It's not him who's putting his legs down. It's this character who's putting the legs down. It's not him who is acting bold and taking up space in the room. It's this character. But, you know, through the process, they internalize this as themselves as well, and then they can take those skills into the world.
It's a sort of a Mr. Miyagi approach.
It is a little Mr. Miyagi-esque.
Yeah, in terms of you go with the movement of the attacker, right, instead of against the attacker. That's what you're meaning.
We do actually a lot of what's often called in I think drama therapy, challenge by choice. Well, on a lot of stuff, I guess. Not specific to genre therapy. And that idea is, in that situation, you know, Adam didn't turn to that young person and say, Gragnold's going to have to put his legs down and he's going to have to, you know, take a wide stance at the table and direct him on how to do that. That young person came up with those ideas on their own.
Yeah. But Adam, you set up a situation in which it was highly likely that he would come to that decision on his own.
And it was right. safe. It was yeah. safe and encouraged.
Yeah. It was safe
and rewarded.
And rewarded after he did it. He stepped up to that challenge. And so that's that sort of space where he gets to say, maybe he would sit how he was, but he would describe Gragnold sitting differently instead,
yeah.
rather than take on his own body language, which would be less of a step up in challenge, but might still be a good reward point for him. That
right.
might still be a good point where it's saying, oh, you took some steps and recognized that those are important things for Gragnold to do here.
Right.
And so that might be rewarded as well.
The other thing is that I didn't ever pathologize the way he was sitting. There is nothing wrong with that inherently. It's totally, you could sit in a chair however you want to. But once you realize that if you speak a little louder, if you reach out to other people around you, being bold, there might be benefits that you didn't realize were there.
Right. So what are the other things that, you know, in 5 years Game to Grow, what's the plethora of bowls that you're going to have your hands in?
Well, right now, like we said, we've been working with tabletop role-playing games and other tabletop games exclusively. We've done a little bit of dabbling in video games. I've actually been, not in a Wheelhouse Workshop context, but just personally working with the Atlantic Street Center down in South Seattle, helping them develop a video game therapy program that's working with dialectical behavioral therapy skills.
What's that going to look like?
Well, it's actually the core gaming program at the Atlantic Street Center. I've been helping them develop their training manual with that. So I have some experience working in video games, in teaching life skills as well. So we're hoping that, or planning on having Game to Grow fold in a lot of the video game intentionality as well.
So that involves, is that individual therapy model?
It's a group therapy model. So,
so clients come to a room, there's a therapist there, and there's you're playing video games with the intention of doing what exactly?
So it's a skills training approach. Okay. So in that case, it's
emotional regulation.
A lot of emotional regulation. So we'll work on the DBT skill of deal, which is about deep breathing and self-encouragement and taking breaks and listening for the quiet. And we'll teach that skill, have them practice it, embody it, and then play a challenging video game in such a way that it will be very beneficial if you know how to self-soothe. If you know how to keep yourself calm and collected, you'll be much better at jumping over things in the game Bit Trip Runner.
Yeah, emotional regulation is such an important thing and so wide-ranging in terms of what it could help in your life. And it's often a goal in therapy for young people. And to use video games not only in a helpful way, because video games can be very frustrating and provide a lot of opportunity, experiential opportunity for emotional regulation, but it also can motivate people to go to therapy, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Interesting. So yeah, I could see that just being just a huge, I could see that being very popular with various different agencies around, the world. So you want to train people to do that and train trainers to do that. I'm guessing.
And train people to be able to facilitate that group and put that together and lead that experience.
Okay.
We also want to be able to expand into one of the big calls that we have heard in a lot of the talks that we've given at PAX and things is being able to serve veterans. And I think that's something that's definitely on the table, and being able to expand groups that might, and those might be tabletop games groups, but what we'd really like to do is take on some people who can be experts on working with veterans, not an area of expertise that Adam and I have, and figure out how to take those same concepts in the same way that we did with social skills, and aiming tabletop games at social skills groups. We want to find out how can we use gaming to help target that and help provide an experience to make it through PTSD with veterans.
Yeah, complicated area. So you plan on going into that area. What else do you guys plan on doing?
There's a lot of other organizations around the country that are doing similar services. They're using games in therapeutic settings, but everybody's kind of in their own silos. And it's not been until very recently that we've been able to start talking to each other, thanks to the internet and thanks to a lot of exposure, thanks to things like Penny Arcade and YouTube of our panels and things like that. A lot of people are starting to come together. And so what we're hoping the Game to Grow can also do is be a hub for these different organizations to come together and share ideas, share approaches. If we need consultation on veterans or sexual offenders, whatever our population might be that's coming to us and looking for services, we might be able to have consultation back and forth for people who are needing that extra help using games for a specific population.
Interesting.
So part of that will be providing sort of an online space where anybody who is interested in the intentional application of games for growth or change can come on and participate in the conversation, be a part of that, and contribute their experiences or even just learn from the experiences of others.
And we'll have people contact us who see us on an article. We got a posted about in Kotaku, which was picked up all around the world. And we had people contacting us from Australia, from Europe, from Indonesia, saying, I want to put a kid in these kinds of services. Do you know of anything that's in my area or even in the Bay Area or in closer places? And so it'd be really nice to be able to have a resource, sort of a Psychology Today of intentional gaming, mm-hmm. so that people could look up and find access to these resources, because we know it's amazingly beneficial, and we would love to be able to serve those populations ourselves. But we're only two people right now in the greater Seattle area. We already run five groups a week. I don't know how far we could go and run more. If we wanted to go as far as south as Olympia, it would be something we would have to hire, but much less getting a group in the Bay Area or Kansas or et cetera.
Indonesia.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So it sounds like you want to have an online directory for people who are either certified or even just, you know, self-claiming to be good at this sort of stuff. That would be a wonderful thing. So you want to train people to be able to do it as well, and just propagate the notion of, and that's, you know, that's the definition of a nonprofit, right? You're not in it for the money. You're in it for the helping of people, essentially. You want to help people, and you think that by propagating this idea and popularizing it and assisting people to learn how to do it, that it will actually help people. That's your purpose.
I think that's been one of the challenges so far in this industry, is a lot of people kind of wanted to keep their cards close to their chest. Mm. They're doing this super cool thing, and they didn't want to tell anybody about it because they wanted it to be theirs. And those silos have come up and they've gone away in various places all over the world. And one of the things that Adam and I struck out to do from the very beginning was not do that. We wanted to go to PAX, and people would say, you're going to PAX, you're just training your competitors. That's all you're doing when you go to PAX, is you're going to tell the world about the stuff you do. You're going to saturate the market with game therapists, and you're going to run out of business. And we didn't believe that. We thought that if we went out there and we shared out these ideas and told people about how we do what we do as much as we can, we would be able to increase the amount of people doing this, which would serve more people. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, it's very altruistic and very Antiochian of you.
I mean, I guess ultimately, if we wanted to look at the really big picture of what we'd love for Game to Grow to accomplish someday, which would be to change the way that people game, to change the way that people view those experiences and help them see the opportunity in that to find improvements or benefits or growth for themselves. If we could introduce that into the population, let them see how beneficial this can be. It gives the opportunity for everybody, professionals and non-professionals alike, to shift their focus and go, well, now that we're playing this game, what do I get out of this experience? How can I improve myself with this?
How can I game better?
Yeah.
How can I game to grow?
What about education experiences and individual? So, you know, because when I hear you say that, Adam, I think of people playing a game by themselves or online with other people by themselves with an intention of trying to help themselves somehow. Are you thinking about that kind of thing too?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, obviously there's a line that we want to really encourage that you shouldn't be doing therapy on yourself, right? And you shouldn't be.
But maybe like a guide that someone could follow that someone in your organization or someone associated sets up that was likely to be helpful and safe.
Exactly. Actually, one of the things that we would love to do at some point, and probably would be within the sort of 5 years, is create a bit of a manual for parents who are not introduced into gaming and who are not a part of that world on how to play games with the family.
Wow.
In a way that is beneficial. There are definitely ways to play games that might not be as encouraging to the experience or as uplifting or as great for encouraging that growth. And even just having something for parents to read to say, if you're going to sit down and you're going to play a game together, if you're going to sit down and play Catan together, how can I encourage that being friendly and trading with each other might actually be more beneficial to you than being cutthroat and trying to cut everybody off at the pass.
Yeah, that's so funny because a friend of mine, I introduced him to Catan, actually a couple, and I was like, oh, let's play Settlers of Catan. And they're like, oh, we played this already and we didn't really like it. And I was like, oh, man, it's the best, you know. And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's like, well, our son hoarded everything and like refused to trade, and it just felt really, you know, not fun. And I was like, oh, well, that's your problem. I mean, that's the problem. And they didn't know about the robber rule, like if you have
the roll seven rule.
If you have eight or more, you have to get rid of half your stuff. You know, mm-hmm. They didn't know about that rule because that you know quickly encourages. You know, that's a rule in the game that encourages. I'm sure in the playtesting of that game, they're like, people hoard stuff, mm-hmm. And so in order to discourage that, you want you got to create this rule because that. I don't know, people play Catan, but having eight resources in your hand is actually pretty common, like mid game. Like you could have 15 resources in your hand. You're just like, oh my god, I got to get rid of this stuff before And so it's funny that you say that, because it does encourage working with people, and you end up being very friendly with people. Like, hey, so I really need this thing, and so that I think that'd be great, having a manual or an online resource for parents. How many parents are worried about their kids' social skills or their kids locking themselves in their room just, by themselves? And how many parents want to have an enriching, meaningful experience with their kids and don't know how to do that, and how wonderful it would be to have a resource like that? And not only a manual, but maybe even like consultation with people that know how to do that kind of stuff, or online videos or
a game
that, what games are good for that kind of stuff, like Catan and that kind of stuff.
So our summer programming right now is using tabletop games other than role-playing games.
Yeah.
And I'm doing write-ups for the parents so they'll know why we chose the games we chose. And then I've talked to board game stores to get coupons so those families can go out with that coupon, get a discount, buy that game, and then play it at home. So a game like Hanabi, which is fantastic cooperative game, but it doesn't feel like one of those educational cooperative games that takes some of the fun away. It's a challenging game that requires trust and communication. And it has a lot of very good opportunities to reflect on how much you need from other people in terms of communication, how much you trust other people. And we played with a 9-year-old. And it's amazing just how much opportunity this 9-year-old had because of our facilitation to be thinking about how much he trusts his teammates. Mm. What is it? What do you need from us? I noticed you have a look on your face that says you're kind of unsure. Mm. And just open reflection of that. And then I can email the parents and say, we played Hanabi. We focused on these things. We think it really boosts the ability to trust each other and to talk about how much you trust each other. Well, I don't know you guys yet. I don't know the way you communicate. It's really a great opportunity for that. And so far, the response from the parents has been really great.
Have you thought about using escape rooms, because that requires a lot of cooperation? Have you ever done an escape room before?
You know, it's on my bucket list.
It's on mine too. I've never done it. It seems so much fun.
As a faculty, we did it for our retreat in June, and that was the first time I'd ever done it on Capitol Hill. And it's actually really fun. I, as a slight claustrophobic, was like, screw that noise. But they don't actually lock the door. It's just kind of, in my head, I was like, you're in this locked space. But it's actually not actually locked. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's a huge, the one I was in, it was a huge room because there's so many puzzles in the room you have to do. And you have to cooperate and you have to communicate with each other. And it's frantic because you have like an hour. The clock is ticking. You know what I mean?
And it's very high challenge. I've heard that, yeah. that like a lot of those escape rooms.
We failed. We completely failed.
We should do one as a Game to Grow board.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
we should. That'd be super fun.
That'd be fun. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I could imagine a Game to Grow philosophy around those kinds of things, or even a Game to Grow endorsed kind of thing, you know, like, because with us, the facilitators are in the room with us, giving us clues occasionally. And in a way, I could absolutely see a person like that elevating their role a little bit more into more facilitation. Like, oh, it looks like you're doing this by yourself. Maybe if you asked a couple questions, you know, because I see you doing this and I, you know, it looks like you're doing great work, but I bet you if you worked with that person over there, it might, because there's a lot of puzzles that fit together that you don't know fit together, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know, just throwing that out there.
No, I think that's a great idea. And actually, because of all the background in role-playing games, Adam and I do quite a lot of that sort of in-character as NPCs when we play Dungeons & Dragons, where the NPC might be like, I hear you're all talking at the same time and I can't understand any of you. Like, that's like a directive to in-character that I can give. Now, all the players now know, okay, well, we have to talk one at a time because this NPC is not going to interact with us unless we take some of that advice that the NPC is sort of offering up. So I can imagine in like a escape room playing a like salty sailor whose role is to like sit there and drink or something and occasionally answer a question to you, and he can be like, I see you all sitting over at that table for a real long time, seems kind of odd to me, like, oh, I guess we should move up from the table, we probably should move around.
Nobody's noticed the small statue on the mantle.
Yeah, I think you've already just made it yourself. Another exciting part of the nonprofit is the connections that you can make with all these various different gaming organizations, like PAX, like Dungeons and Dragons itself, you know, different video games. And because there's a lot of philanthropy that they involve themselves in anyway, and would love to, you know, and already are connecting themselves with you guys and promoting and donating things and being a place that they can get excited about, right? Is that true?
Mm-hmm. We actually had a friend who worked for Wizards of the Coast in the Dungeons & Dragons, and he gave us a box of books. Because then he said, the people over at Wizards of the Coast, I love what you guys are doing. So here's a bunch of books, and just a stack of books, of Dungeon Master's Guides, Player's Handbooks, all the modules and things, dice, little minis, kinds of stuff.
Oh, my God.
And we're not even a nonprofit. So there's a lot of support that we get from out there in the community. So we're really looking forward to being a nonprofit, because then it serves two purposes. A lot of these big corporations want to do good, and so they are looking for the right organization to do good with, and we serve their mission in many ways. When we met with someone over at Wizards of the Coast, you know, they're owned by Hasbro, and Hasbro has a very strong mission to support communities.
Yeah.
And when we spoke with them before, they said, you're not a nonprofit, so we can't make a thing out of it. You know, we can give you a little bit, some stickers and some books and stuff. But in the event that you're not a nonprofit, there's not much we can do.
We can't have an official relationship with you.
Right. And certainly not a sponsorship or anything like that.
Yeah.
But if we got to the point, I mean, we've met a lot of the people over there at Wizards of the Coast and who have given us sort of verbal thumbs up. It's been great, but we would love to be able to tell the world how much we're using their products to improve people's lives.
Right.
And then they can help our mission, which is getting it out there and supporting more people in a way, because they have a marketing arm that is across the world.
And some of the idea of being a nonprofit is in trust. When you're a for-profit company, you know, we were given all those books. They might assume we're going to go sell them or we're going to go do whatever we want with them. And the idea of a nonprofit is that we get to say we're very clearly doing this for charitable purposes and for trying to reach out and do good things with this stuff. And now all of a sudden companies and individuals who might not know us that well can trust that what we're doing here is charitable and it is trying to work towards helping the community or helping individuals.
Yeah. What sort of community building, besides going into communities that wouldn't be able to afford your services, what kind of community building stuff are you going
to
do?
We know there's lots of libraries that are trying to get kids to come into libraries, to give them opportunities to get off the streets, to have an activity that doesn't require any money to participate in, really. If even in our Dungeons & Dragons groups, the kids don't have to bring anything. We print all their character sheets for them. We provide pencils and dice. And if a library or other sort of community center could have a game day or a game night where kids could come in an after-school program in a way that they're not just going to go home and be by themselves or get into trouble, you know, we see it as an opportunity for extracurricular community support.
Wow.
In a way for these kids to also have a hobby, something they can do at low cost, especially in low-income communities, that the small buy-ins, you can really do it with rocks, like you said. Gary Gygax, before he discovered the 20-sided die, used to have poker chips in a bag that were marked 1 through 20. Oh. You can do it with a deck of cards. Just write a number on each card and have 20 cards.
Yeah.
There's ways you can make this totally accessible to really anybody. And so we want to make sure that those barriers are broken down. And after-school groups, libraries, other community centers can really bring their kids in and give their kids a place to be safe and do something that's good for them.
You guys are geeks, right?
Oh, yeah.
I'd say so.
Do you enjoy your job? Is this like you get a geek out at work?
Absolutely. I mean, it is work. I'm not going to lie to you. There is a lot of serious work. We love to come to podcasts and talk about all of the fun stuff about playing Dungeons & Dragons for 8 hours a week. That's awesome. There is also the planning process where we have to think about the therapeutic intentions and we think about all that stuff. And then we think about how to translate that into a giant spider combat.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of fun with that, too.
And there's also, I mean, and I think this is true for all therapists, there are times where clients can be frustrating.
Yeah.
Where you come in and you're really trying to help a client move forward and they're really having trouble taking that next step, or they're really having trouble picking up what you're putting down, so to speak. They're having trouble kind of latching onto that. And that happens in our groups, too. There are times where it can be frustrating in the game. And especially with the populations we work with.
So it's not all fun and games.
No, it's not all fun and games. There's a lot of games, and there's a pretty good amount of fun.
80% games.
Fun and games.
Fun
at work,
fun.
You know, enjoying your work.
We do actually have a lot of fun, though. That's people ask us, like, how can I do this? How can I start a company called, like Wheelhouse Workshop? And I'll be like, well, first thing you have to do is find someone with the same name as you that you work really well with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who will like...
It helps if you're both named Adam.
Yeah.
In our experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you
the
like...
Adams.
You like similar music and it helps.
You talk
someone you
similar
can spend
10 voices.
Hours a day with is pretty easy because we work long days.
Do you do groups together?
Mm-hmm. To some extent. So there's sort of a limit. If you're familiar with Dungeons & Dragons, there's a limit to how many people you can really comfortably have at one table with one dungeon master. And so our groups are kind of maxed out at 8 people. And that means that Adam and I each split into 2 tables of 4 players and 1 dungeon master. We often play in the same room, although in our new space that we're going to be having, we'll be able to have separate rooms, which helps cut down on noise between groups.
Yeah, right.
But we'll often do check-in together and have a chance to sort of answer questions and have some relationship with the other table. And then Adam and I will split up into different tables and run each of our own games. And sometimes those games are very similar or even crossover between each other, and sometimes those games are hugely different because of the different challenges of the players at the table.
So to wrap this up, then, people can donate, obviously, to the nonprofit by going to gametogrow.org.
Gametogrow.org, yeah.
Gametogrow.org, and it's a T-O, Game to Grow.
Gametogrow.org, yes.
.org.
All spelled out, no numbers.
No numbers. It's not like a Prince song, you know. And you can donate there if you're interested in donating either funds or even materials if you're someone from a, you know, some kind of gaming organization.
Those donations will go to helping us get our new offices set up, make it a great gaming experience for all the players who are coming to those offices, as well as helping scholarship for players to attend those groups who otherwise might not be able to afford it, and helping us expand, helping us get this out to other people.
Right, helping expand to all those 5-year plan sort of stuff that we were talking about. And they can also go to gametogrow.org to, you know, in perpetuity, to learn about the new developing programs and other kinds of things. Right now, it's pretty much a lot of planning, and also in Kirkland, Washington, near Seattle, you have a space where young people will come and you know, involve themselves in these gaming groups for social skills that you're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
But in the future, Game to Grow will have more. The GameToGrow.org will have more things on there. So if you're listening to this in 5 years, I congratulate you on the next president of the United States, other than Donald Trump. And I also am wondering what's on the GameToGrow.org website by that point. You know, because it just seems like there's a lot of energy around this, a lot of excitement about it. You know, when you guys asked me to do it, I don't have a lot of time in my life to dedicate to things. And so I was just like, because people ask me to be on board sometimes, and I'm just like, But when you guys came to me, I asked you a few questions, and I was just like, actually, like, this could be huge. Because I am fairly sure that in probably, honestly, like 30 years or something, or 20 years, maybe 50 years, like, what we're talking about in the future, people will be like, well, yeah, duh. I mean, of course. What therapist doesn't play video games with their clients? Like, that's ridiculous. How do you possibly do anything with a client without, you know, playing a game that they enjoy? I mean, it's so easy to do. You just create a game that they like, and then, you know, you slip in a few therapeutic things. I mean, it's simple, you know. I'm sure we're going to be there at some point, you know. I'm sure at some point there's going to be a bridging of the gap, because as gaming teenagers grow up and have kids, there's more of a, you know, there's more of a bridge now between the old people with power and the young people that are actually playing these games. And so I'm sure that this is like where we're headed, but we are so far from that mark right now. We are so far from it. And I just think it's like, man, you know, I want to be there just seems like there's so much potential. There's so much, it's like there's this fertile field just waiting to be, you know, seeded with, you know, your guys' stuff. And that will, I think, undoubtedly be helpful to people and interesting to people. And so I thought, man, you know, that sounds like a good journey to go on with you guys, you know, to be a part of. It's sort of like with this, just incidentally, it's sort of like with this podcast. When in 2008, when I was listening, you know, I was like, oh, I love podcasts, you know, and listening to science podcasts, history podcasts. I was like, what about psychology podcasts? And so I was like, downloaded all the main psychology podcasts, and I was just like, man, there's not a lot of good psychology podcasts out there.
Yeah.
No offense against the ones that were out at the time, but I was like, man, like, if someone came along and, like, just created sort of a half-assed podcast, it would probably, you know, be at least somewhat listened to, you know? And little old me, not knowing anything about radio or anything at all, because of how of an open field it was, just without any players, you know? I think at the time in 2008, there were, like, three podcasts that were about psychology. Just three.
Wow,
now imagine
crazy.
Today, right? You know,
yeah.
With all the, but still, there's not a lot of podcasts about psychology even today. So my point is that that's exciting to me. You know, as it just for me personally, it's exciting to like get on the ground level. You know, imagine in the '90s with the .com boom. You know, you understand how .coms work. You know, it's just like it's just like interesting to be at that beginning phase of something. You know, and see it grow into the future. I think it's going to take time, because I think all those cultural barriers are still around, and I don't think it's going to, like, I mean, it'd be great if it did, but I don't think it's going to take off as fast as it should. But I'm pretty sure in like 50 years, this people listen to this and be like, they didn't back then. That's just so dumb. You know, what were they thinking? Right.
Yeah.
Thanks for asking me, I guess, is my point there.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, we went through like a kind of a long list and really narrowed things down. We asked you to be a part of the board because of your passions for not only for all the podcast stuff that you put together, but like your passions for geek and psychology, and being able to take both those areas. Those are obviously hugely important things. And like you said, it's it's so limited for how many therapists are really involved or really interested and engaged in that geek community, and how much those two areas are so isolated from each other. And I think that they're ready to combine. I think they're ready to join in and recognize how integrated a lot of geek culture and a lot of geek things are into other parts of our lives. Let's jump on board that and recognize all the good pieces of it.
Yeah. Little did I know when I was rolling that pebble in the fifth grade that it would lead me to this moment.
Yeah.
any final word from either Adam?
We don't want you to game more. We want you to game better. We want you to game to grow.
Awesome. Well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining me, Adam Davis and Adam Johns. Again, there's a public event, Antioch University, September 7th, 2017, depending on when you're listening to this. And also gametogrow.org. Also, there's going to be Twitter at gametogrow, all spelled out, no numbers. And expect to have other podcasts, episodes about this. Maybe we'll do some micro stuff. Maybe we'll even play some games.
We talked about trying to do a D&D game podcast or something.
We should do that next time. I feel like people, because so many people don't know what Dungeons & Dragons is, and they think of it as this, you know, terrible thing. And, or, you know, again, because people ask me, where are you going on Sundays? You know, and I just, Dungeons & Dragons, what? Like, what? Like, actually, it's funny, our last board meeting, people were coming over to my house for a dinner party, and they were arriving before I got home, and they were being told, oh, you know, he's at this Dungeons & Dragons thing. And they're like, oh, that's great. It's great. So Kirk's helping people to stop playing Dungeons & Dragons? That's what they thought it was. They thought,
wow,
this Game to Grow was an organization to stop people from playing Dungeons & Dragons. And I was like, actually, it's the opposite.
Yeah, we've got to work that out for us.
So I feel like we should play a game to demonstrate that it's actually like loads of fun. It's quite possibly the funnest game I've ever played in my life, you know, and so we should do that next time.
Yeah,
that'd be super fun. I want to hear all your voices.
Oh my God.
I want to hear all those voices.
I've got lots of them.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. All right, well, that does it for that episode. Thanks for joining me, Adam and Adam. Please take care of yourself out there, because you all deserve it.